Okay. Hi, this is Chris. So we'll start out with the slides that we have, and we'll just take you through first on slide three, which is just a time frame from when the standard leases was issued in 2016. The FASB did not create a TRG for leases, but of course, stood ready to answer all questions, which we have done so, and which we continue to do so. We did some standards heading a lot in 2018 and one document in 2019, and we'll hit on that in the next slides. Leases, of course, when effective on January 1st of this year for public businesses and entities, and is supposed to go effective for non-PBEs 1/1/20, but based on last week's board meeting, this could be pushed out by a year. If we move on to slide four, this just gives you a high level view of that the board has met 11 times since the standard was issued. And again, the standard setting that was done in 2018 and 2019 on the right hand side, I would say that the largest, what I view is the largest thing that the board addressed was transition, which I believe that the we allowed an approach that the IASB allows, whereby an entity could adopt a standard as of its effective date with a cum effect adjustment as of that date, as opposed to in the first reporting period that is presented. And then the rest of the standard setting, for the most part, was done around lessor accounting. Slide five just gives you an overview of the questions by type that we've received. As you can see, mostly lessee accounting, transition, and to a smaller extent, lessor accounting. And then finally, the last slide just shows that that the trend of questions that we've received has gone downward since 2016, although we still work with the large firms with the SEC on substantive questions that we get. And then lastly, as Russ had mentioned at last week's board meeting, we are going to work with our stakeholders to understand what were the difficult issues that they faced and what were the difficult top topics in the LISA standard, and see if we can put out some Q&As, or perhaps if we need to stand standards up. So that's what I have. I'll stop there for any questions.
Any questions, or do we want to add on from outside? Or?
I think we were going to
go to the revenue and then we'll turn it over.
I had a question.
Anne, yes.
It was in relation to slide 11 when you're talking about the evidence gathering process. A couple of questions. One was, is there anything new in the process you're using that you haven't used before? And then secondly, in terms of reaching out to the academics, And I know that one way you'd be doing that is presenting at conferences and various meetings and letting them know the issues that evidence would be useful. Is there anything else that you're trying, any new initiatives in terms of reaching the academics? So any new tools or any...
We can maybe hold that. We're going to cover that, so we can hold that question.
On slide six.
Yeah, it was just if there's anything on leases. I'll go through the slides and then we can come back to it.
Okay. You have time to consider that.
So if we're good with leases, we'll move on to revenue. So revenue, if we go to slide eight, we're kind of in an interesting time because we're concurrently working on implementation for private companies and not-for-profits, and at the same time we've had publics have adopted in 2018, so we're doing our post-adoption monitoring of how it went, and I'll go through some of the details on what that process is and what we've been doing and next steps. On slide nine, just a quick snapshot of inquiries. So because the private companies and not-for-profits haven't adopted yet, you can see we've still got some volume here in terms of inquiries. It's a fairly low volume, but still getting questions. Most of the questions are, you know, mostly basic educational questions, but we're continuing to make ourselves available as issues arise. And then on the public companies, last year we kicked off our post-effective date monitoring process. So on slide 11, this is a snapshot of our overall plan, and we're in year two, I suppose, since it was effective last year. So kind of focusing on that first block, what we've completed to date is we've been having discussions with all of our advisory groups, understanding what the costs were of the standard, getting feedback from them, from the users, getting some early feedback on what they're seeing and early benefits. We completed a survey with our public company constituents, and I'll go through that in the next slides, to get some feedback focused on costs. In that first bucket, we're also thinking about how we can gather additional feedback through possibly a roundtable or, you know, more detailed feedback that you can't really get in a survey, possibly through, you know, one-on-one discussions, things of that nature. And then the longer range plan, you know, as we get more trending on revenue and we're further out, continuing to look at costs, academic studies, so on and so forth. And this process, you know, although I've got it teed up here in the context of revenue, this would be the same process that we would apply to leases. So the idea is, you know, leases following a year later would go through something similar. On the public company survey on slide 12, what we did is we focused on costs, and we wanted to get information kind of real time now that companies have just adopted. Let's find out how things went. And we used the board's basis for conclusions kind of as a starting point. So in the basis for conclusions, there were certain costs that the board expected would occur, and we wanted to test whether those did occur, were there additional costs that we hadn't anticipated, and so on and so forth. So you can see here the survey was about a number of items such as personnel, IT systems, audit costs. You know, were the costs, did they occur? Were they higher than expected? What was the experience? And we surveyed public companies, and we focused on preparer groups. So from our advisory groups, we looked at preparers in the advisory group, so in our FASAC, our Small Business Advisory Committee. And then we also reached out to some preparer groups, so IMA and FEI, and asked them to distribute it to their members to see if they would respond. And we ended up getting, on slide 13, 42 participants in this survey. So we got a mix of industries. You can see here how it's sliced. The bulk of the companies are very large companies, and that's from the population that we were drawing from, being our advisory group members in FEI and IMA. But we wanted to use this as kind of a first round to see what the reception of the survey is, what kind of results, so we could continue to refine and think about where we might want to gather data. On slide 14, we've got some of our preliminary findings. So I think at a high level, we found that the cost the board expected to occur did occur. So some of those things were, you know, new processes and controls, hiring additional employees or consultants, external audit fees, and costs that the board is expected to be non-recurring were generally non-recurring. Two observations we have here about the cost is that it seems like personnel costs were higher than maybe were expected, and IT costs were lower. But again, this is the first round of the survey, so we'd have to delve a little deeper to see you know, if that holds true and maybe what those reasons are. In terms of unexpected costs, dual bookkeeping was one that came up. About 20% of the companies we surveyed said they were doing dual bookkeeping, you know, possibly for statutory basis. But we did see on benefits, increased convergence between IFRS and US GAAP, and then also improved understanding of revenue activities. So going through the adoption of the standard required companies to go through and really understand their contracts, to apply the five-step standard. So I think there were some benefits there in terms of them understanding better how, you know, what specific terms were in some of these contracts and where maybe they had abnormalities or they weren't necessarily contracting consistently. The next couple of slides have some next steps, which I'm just going to hit on quickly. You know, as I mentioned, we have some preliminary observations about cost, but we had a fairly small sample size and high-level observations, so we'll want to dig deeper into that. And also with next year, the private companies, you know, having financial statements under 606, we can apply the process that we did for publics and transition that to also apply to privates and try to gather some feedback on costs of private companies. In terms of benefits, as I'd mentioned, you know, we talked to our investor groups early on to get some initial reactions to what they were seeing in the standard. But as we get further out from the adoption date and we get comparability in multiple years on the new standard, we'll want to monitor what the feedback is from the investors. We're monitoring, you know, investment reports that they might publish about the standard. We see a lot of industry reports about what the impacts are and what they're seeing. So continuing to look at that. Because really the early on work has been focused on cost, so the benefits we expect to be a little trailing. So we'll focus on that in the future. And then on slide 17, as I also mentioned, longer term in that kind of five-plus year bucket was academic studies. Moving on to post-adoption issues. You know, so the first section was post-adoption monitoring, and this is really any issues coming up after adoption. And what we've really been doing a great job with Henry and Petrina here is monitoring what each board is doing, where we're getting questions. You know, we're monitoring IFRIC, which they'll go through. We're sharing our EITF issues with them to make sure that we're collectively thinking about the issues, different angles, gathering thoughts, and making sure we're kind of in the loop on as questions arise that we're you know, sharing information and continuing to collaborate. On slide 20, we've received two agenda requests on topic 606 that relate to one project that the board's added to the agenda, and this relates to licenses of IP. So this was added to the board's agenda. The board added to the EITF's agenda in May of this year. The EITF has not done any decision making yet. We had an educational meeting in June and have formed a working group where we're looking at alternatives. And expect to probably have some decision-making on this in the fall. It's related to licenses of IP and when you add rights and remove rights, how does that all work under the standard? And this is an area that was raised to us through an agenda request that there's some diversity the firms are seeing in practice. So this is something that we're actively working on and, again, you know, have shared this with the ISB team and received input on this, so we'll continue to collaborate. So with that, on slide 21, questions for the boards, and again, this is just on what the FASB is doing on revenue, and then after we go through the discussion, I'll turn it over to Henry and Petrina to talk about what they're doing from the IFRS perspective. But I'll open up for discussion if there's any questions from any of the board members.
Given that these are two big new standards, I was wondering, in all the outreach activities that you're doing, are you doing anything that you consider to be new or different, you know, and how's that working out? Mm-hmm. And then my second question was, I think Christine's going to take it, in terms of there's ways that we normally make contact with academics to encourage them to do relevant research, but I just wondered if there was any other things, any new things that you've been trying.
So on the first question, I would say the only thing different that we've been doing is in the past, you know, the Financial Accounting Foundation would do a lot of the post-adoption work and the surveys, and that's something that we're doing closer to the adoption date for revenue. So typically that would have trailed a couple of years, but what we wanted to do is, these are big standards, let's get the feedback from people while it's fresh. So the survey is something new that we've done. And that kind of dovetails a little bit with the academics. I'll just comment and then I can hand it over to Christine. You know, in the past year, we had our first academic fellow. So he was integral to developing the survey questions with us and the methodology to make sure that we don't have biased questions and helping us gather that feedback. So it's a little bit of a different process than we've done in the past. And I think, you know, it also helps generate ideas of where there might be academic studies in the future, but I'll turn it over to Christine for more commentary.
Yeah, our postdoctoral fellow program, we have our second one now. Kurt Gee just left us to take a position at Penn State University. Our new postdoc fellow just joined us, and one of the requirements of that position is that they act as a liaison between the FASB and the academic community with an eye to helping to shape future academic studies. So there's a couple of mechanisms that have been put into place. One is when an academic has a paper that they would like the board to see or the staff to see, it now goes into there's an email that they attach it to, and it comes to the board, and it goes directly to the postdoc. And then the postdoc looks at the paper, identifies what team could benefit from the paper, and if they think that the paper is worth the time of having the team look at it, then the postdoc reads the paper, the team reads the paper, they get together and discuss it, and then feedback that comes out of that process, the postdoc then passes back to the co-authors of the paper. And tries to, you know, sort of influence the work that they're doing through that feedback. So that's one mechanism. Another mechanism is that the postdoc goes around to all of the major conferences and is networking and sort of providing feedback. And then, of course, the postdoc is also getting papers to review and is providing their perspectives on those papers that they're reviewing as part of the review process for journals. So that's at the helping to shape future academic studies. I'm hoping at some point, and that's why I was asking about your conference, is that perhaps down the path in the year 5+, we might be able to partner with a journal to have a conference on a topic such as revenue and put out a call for papers a year in advance and then use that conference as a way to try to get sort of the cutting-edge knowledge together. But that's on my wish list. It's not it's not something that we've pursued yet. Thank you.
Sue?
So just, Anne, just in response of the processes that Mary just talked about, as I think about it and I think about what we're doing here, a lot of it is perhaps a bit more structured in terms of making sure that these are processes that can be applied on each of the comprehensive standards that we issue and then, you know, to varying degrees on other standards. And when I think about that process, I also think about what it yields. And certainly Mary talked about the benefits and the costs and things like that, but also thinking about, well, what does that tell us about our process? Do we need to make changes real time? Are there questions that have come up that we can help implementation? Like, particularly Chris talked about the questions on leasing that we can think about as to whether there's implementation guidance that's needed for private companies because we have the staggered effective dates. And so, you know, you kind of asked whether they're new. It's more structured. Some of them maybe are being done at different times or maybe more formalized than what we've done in the past, but it yields different activities as a result of the information.
Thanks, Jade.
Mary. From Mary to Mary, slide 19. I want to say how much I have valued and benefited from, you know, knowing that this was going on, the staff-to-staff consultation about issues coming in, keeping each other apprised. I know it from the interpretation committee work, the ability that I have to ask a question and say, you know, are things developing differently on this one, you know, in a U.S. GAAP environment has been very helpful. And I also hear from those outside this organization, from stakeholders across stakeholder types, that especially when it comes to the major projects that we have, you know, that we work so hard on getting to, you know, convert either full convergence or convergence on key items, that having some kind of mechanism, having some kind of effort to keep that has been, they value it and they're glad to hear it's happening. And so I just wanted to give a shout out to this slide and say how much I have valued that.
Very good. Then turn to the our staff.
Yeah.
Yep. Katrina, are you going to? Yes.
Yes, I'm going to do. Thank you, Hans, and good afternoon. So if we turn to paper 12B, then this really outlines sort of where we've been spending our time in the context of revenue and leases over the last sort of 12 to 18 months. So two main areas. First, in dealing with application questions, which has also resulted in some narrow scope standard setting. But secondly, in doing some monitoring of what's being disclosed. So maybe if I turn to slide three. Slide three really sets out the application questions related to IFRSs 15 and 16 that have been discussed by the Interpretations Committee and where agenda decisions have been published. And only to reiterate once again, by the way, just how helpful we found being able to speak to Mary and Chris and their teams, by the way, on these sort of as soon as we get the questions in and before they ever come in front of the committee for discussion. So that has been really very helpful indeed. What would I highlight on these? I suppose, first of all, on IFRS 15, we had quite a few questions about the pattern of revenue recognition, so point in time versus over time. And I suppose, in a sense, that wasn't necessarily a surprise because we knew that was an area of IFRS 15 that was going to create some change, and particularly would create some change in the context of real estate contracts in particular jurisdictions. The other thing I'll highlight is probably what's been actually particularly interesting for us is actually the number of questions that we've got on old standards, but that arise because of the interaction now between sort of the old standard and the new standards. So for example, we recently had a question on IAS 23 about whether to capitalise borrowing costs linked to a revenue contract, and we had a couple of questions on joint operation accounting, but specifically to do with how to account for lease liabilities or how to recognise revenue when you're in joint operations. So those were questions on IFRS 11, not on the new standards, but very much linked to the interactions with the new standards. And I suppose that's really kind of flowed through on slide four as well in terms of the narrow scope standard setting. So the first two you'll note on that slide are proposed amendments to IAS 37. And IAS 12, of course, neither of which are about revenue or leases. But those proposed amendments are very much related to the initial application of IFRS 15 and IFRS 16, and actually came from application questions that came to the committee about how to apply these requirements in the context of applying the new standards. So maybe then if I just move on to slide sort of 5 to 7, just talk a bit about some monitoring that we're doing in terms of disclosures that we're starting to see. On slide 6, we just noted some headline, very much headline, 10,000 feet observations, which of course are not really new news. But nonetheless, we think this is kind of important for us to see what's coming through initially, both to help inform us if we need to act in any way. And also it is quite informative for the disclosure initiative as well. So I know you've just been talking about that, but the reason it's particularly useful is that both IFRS 15 and IFRS 16 have quite an objectives-based approach to disclosure. So we're particularly interested in seeing how that sort of plays out in practice, and then hopefully that'll be informative to the work happening on disclosure as well. And I'll just add, of course, that talking about this sort of initial disclosure and what we're seeing is something that's sort of a regular item in any of our discussions with the regulatory community. And just finally on slide 7, we just put together some quantitative information that we've obtained from some of the transition disclosures and leases. The caveat on this, of course, is, as it says, is these numbers have been derived from information we've seen disclosed by only 10 early adopters. But in saying that, some of the trend and the information we saw here, we've seen sort of replicated in other, say, investor presentations by some companies that are applying the standard in 2019. And just to highlight what's actually been most interesting for us in this sort of reconciliation is actually the increase in liabilities recognised because of the inclusion of payments in optional periods, so periods when companies have assessed that they're reasonably certain to extend a lease. And we weren't necessarily, I suppose, expecting such a big increase. So just to highlight that number on slide 7, that's the 1.992 billion that you see on that slide. So I think with that, I will stop talking and hand over to you if you have any particular comments or questions for us.
This is all crystal clear. As usual, Katrina. Good job. Oh, no.
Sorry. I have a process-related question, and I think I might have read something that provides some insight, but I can't quite put my finger on it. So, you know, we've gotten these couple agenda requests, if you will, subsequent to the on revenue recognition specifically. The EITF, the board's picked up on the agenda. EITF's looking at it. And I wondered if you have any different philosophy in terms of the issues that arise post-adoption in about whether or if, you know, there are, the IFRIC can provide an agenda decision without concern about a transition. And I was just curious about that because it's certainly something as we get questions in after a standard's been adopted, and particularly with revenue recognition, it's something, and we see diversity in practice that we think about. And I was just wondering from the IFRIC and the issues that you've gotten in post-effective date, if that's a concern or consideration. But I seem to remember there was something, Sue, I'm looking at you, but was you posted or issued?
I think there's a couple of things. Firstly, we can only put things in agenda decisions if they don't add to the requirements. So the agenda decisions can only cover things that are already in the words and are, in a sense, confirming what the requirements are. So given that we're just repeating what's already in the requirements, there's no transition per se, but it's a relatively narrow population. If we do anything where we actually want to sort of fill a gap or make a change, then we need to do narrow scope standard setting, and then we'll have a proper, you know, exposure process even for agenda decisions. But we would have a full exposure draft process, and that would come with transition because it would be filling in gaps or changing requirements in some way. So it would follow naturally. I think maybe what you might be touching on as well as though is the comments that we've been making about the time you get to apply agenda decisions, because that's where there has been some discussion. And if my name's attached to it, it's probably that. And that's because there's been a sort of live question under our standards for a long time, which is if an agenda decision is merely reminding people what the requirements already are, in a sense, does that mean as soon as we issue an agenda decision, you've got an error if you're doing something different? Or secondly, does that mean that if we issue an agenda decision in the middle of March, that it has to be, you have to change your accounting if it needs to be changed for your next reporting period, even if that's only a few weeks away? So we've tried to make it more clear, and the process is ongoing through the due process handbook review, that we see agenda decisions as providing another source of information because it's pulling pieces of information together. So it's not typically an error, it's a new piece of information, so you know you don't have a problem, but you should look at your accounting going forward. But also the other thing we've tried to do to try and help with the system is to for the board to confirm that we think that people are entitled to a sufficient amount of time to implement the changes that can arise as a result of the new information that's come from an agenda decision. And then, of course, as soon as we said that people should be allowed a sufficient amount of time, everybody said, well, what's a sufficient amount of time? And that's where we have I wrote an article, which is on the website, that just gives some colour for what sorts of things to think about. Yeah. And it's basically saying we think people should be allowed enough time to implement the change. So that means if you need to make systems changes, collect new data, you know, to get it to auditable quality, we know that takes time and that's not a five-minute exercise, but it will vary by entity. Some people it'll be a quick change, some people it won't affect them at all. So it's sort of facts and circumstances specific, but I think we use the phrase, we're thinking months, not years. But that's where that timing question probably has come up.
Okay. I think that brings us to the end of discussions today.
We have special sessions.
AOB.
And, yeah.